Hey, here's one for you. So somebody posted on my wall on the goddamn Facebook the thing again about abracadabra being something says I create what I speak or whatever. And I looked it up and it literally means do as I say. And then I came to find out that that's actually the consensus amongst rabbis is that abracadabra ending with a hey and not an aleph means do as I say. But then, I'm looking at this page where someone's analyzing it, and they point out that in the Klein's Hebrew Dictionary, the entry immediately before abracadabra with an aleph at the end is abrak. Avrak? I don't know how you say this because I don't think it's Aramaic, but basically aleph, bet, resh, kaf, final, means. This means serious. So the Hebrew word for serious is right next door to abracadabra and contains the root part of abracadabra in the word. And so isn't it kind of freaky with 9/11 that you have all of this focus around the dog named Sirius who died in the tower, was a fire dog that they had this whole ceremony ritual around. I don't need to get into the whole thing, but I don't know. I've just That's one example of why that's weird, but that is kind of weird.
Have you ever seen that movie, Chimatica?
Was that
Yeah, I do know what you're talking about, absolutely.
is that
Kind of
this
same place as that guy's in a certain way. It's got the guy talking while they're going through the pictures.
Oh, okay.
It's talking about somatics, the vibrations where you can vibrate the. You
Totally.
ever seen, they put the. And they make the patterns. And it's almost kind of comparing that to what's happening in all of society. So it's kind of putting it out there like there's something going on where the politics, even though the politicians don't know that they're playing the part, they're just vibrating on the plate. And sometimes maybe these serious sinks, there's so many of them. There's so many different things that fall around Sirius, and a lot of themes have that going for it. Just like I was saying earlier with the rabbit, you know, maybe that's all this vibrations going on, and we're picking up on it because we're just another vibrating particle.
That's the two suns in the sunset thing, being that our sun moves with Sirius in the same way that our earth moves with our moon around a center that's so far away, you know, it's like practically inferred. You know what I'm talking about? Have you ever heard that before?
No.
So, I'm no expert, and if somebody wants to refute this, I'm more than welcome to hear it. But from what I understand, you know, our Earth and the Moon have this relationship around the Sun, right? So we're spinning with the Moon around the Sun. So the same way that we do that with the Moon, our Sun in the center of our solar system is doing that with Sirius around this other center.
That's
Which,
cool.
yeah, it's pretty cool. And so I take that as like one of the meanings of like you know, like in the Final Cut where they have two suns in the sunset, and like on Tatooine on Star Wars, there's like two suns. I mean, people take that as Jupiter as a second sun, which I'm open to, you know, especially with 2010 and everything. But I don't know. It's
I just want to point out that, you know, when you look in the night sky, the constellation of Canis Major, you know, Sirius is called the dog star. It's part of that dog constellation. It's actually chasing Lepus, the rabbit. So they are paired together in the night sky, and I feel like there's this constant connection between these things. I feel like the rabbit and the dog are always kind of go hand in hand, and just again as a personal validation, when I wrote that book, Happy Creatures, the two main characters, like that. So there's like two main characters, and then there's two main, almost like Obi-Wan Kenobis, you know, like those other characters that they go to. I don't know what you'd call that, not like a supporting character, you know. And is a dog and a rabbit, and then I start having these serious experiences, and I look at the constellations, and I'm like, oh shit, they're already together. So whatever, there's that. Now, while I was looking, trying to find for you the Robert Anton Wilson talk where he talks about rabbits and rationalism, all this sort of stuff, I find that it's called the New Inquisition. And I've dropped that link, that YouTube link, in here. into the Skype chat, and I'll include it in the show notes. It's Robert Anton Wilson. He does a lecture called The New Inquisition, where he talks about all this stuff. However, there's also a book that he wrote, and I want you to look at the cover of this book. Anyone's listening along, Google Robert Anton Wilson, The New Inquisition, and I just drop the link in here, and tell me that doesn't look like all those World Trade Center photos you've seen of the sun between the Twin Towers.
Yeah, that's the only Robert Anton Wilson book I ever read was The New Inquisition, and I read it probably 11 years ago or something like that.
Oh, for some reason the link I sent you doesn't, it's working.
I'm trying to look at for the book on my shelf, actually.
I guess I'll try and, but if you just Google the Robert Anton Wilson, The New Inquisition, and you'll see, you should see this book cover, what I'm talking about here. Pretty damn interesting.
Oh, there it is.
It shows a candle
yeah.
in front of the skyline.
Totally. And it even looks like the Building 7 behind the candle.
Uh-huh, exactly. Exactly. And this book is from 1991.
Yeah, this book was given to me by a very good friend of mine who I just found out recently died of cancer. So I was out of touch with him for a little bit. And he introduced me to a lot of things. He introduced me to Robert Anton Wilson, and this was the one he said was his favorite, and he had read everything by him, so it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
Here's one. Speaking of cancer, I see, I like to think that if any of this talk about consciousness and reality connecting makes sense or is realistic, then it would be really easy to think that we could control our health the same way. What's inside of our body. So while we're so, like, while I'm acting like it, I'm so tied in with everything outside of my body that somehow my thoughts have something to do with it, then I tie that into my own body. And since then, I have found myself feeling real healthy, you know, for the past 20 or so years. I've taken on a different kind of attitude, which is like, I kind of pay attention to what messages I'm inputting. It's as important for me not to listen to the right signals as it is for me not to eat the wrong kind of foods. More important, because I feel like that's what's making the wrong kind of foods the wrong kind of foods.
Right.
And sometimes I listen to the stuff that we're getting from the TV and stuff, and all the people that are talking about their illnesses and talking about their ailments that they can't shake, and I'm like, oh man, you're the ones that are feeding us the information that's making it that way, and you don't even know it. So the doctors and the people that are the different shows, the programs on TV especially, that are out there that are saying all these things, do you guys, I sometimes feel like I'm like, I feel like a lot of people don't see it this way, and it makes me feel like I'm trying to push something that's not realistic.
Well, there is. I'm going to recommend to you. I'll send you the YouTube link for this as well. Michael Talbot, he's the guy who wrote the book "The Holographic Universe."
Yeah,
there's a wonderful interview he did for a TV show called "Thinking Aloud," and it's on YouTube. And the video is called "Synchronicity in the Holographic Universe: Thinking Aloud." Allowed, and he talks about a cancer patient who, I'm going to try my best to tell the story. Basically, the guy has cancer. He's dying. He goes to the doctor. He has like huge tumors, and the doctor's like, "Oh, this guy's fucked." So, but then they find out about this experimental cancer cure, and they try it. He injects the guy with this stuff, and the guy is cured. Boom! It worked. All his tumors go away. And then this study comes out that says, actually, the drug's ineffective. And the guy reads this study that says the drug doesn't work, and suddenly, boom, all his tumors come back. So the doctor goes, I wonder if it's some sort of psychological thing that actually, you know, the way a placebo would work. So he tries literally a placebo and tells the guy, "Hey, listen, yeah, I read the same study that this drug doesn't work to cure cancer, but I've got a new version of it that's supposed to be even better." and he injects the guy with the fucking placebo. And then all the guy's tumors vanish. And then finally the guy reads, like, you know, a few months pass, and they put out some final study on the drug, and it says, well, we just can't seem to find that this is actually effective. The drug doesn't work. It was like the final scientific study on it. The guy reads it, all his tumors come back, and he dies. And so Talbot uses this as an example of how much control do we really have over our health. And he makes the point, it's a really funny thing, he says, you know, I constantly tell myself not to eat a donut because it's going to make me fat and, you know, unhealthy. He's like, but I wonder, am I telling myself that when I'm eating the donut? Like, is there a way? He doesn't, you know, say, it's not like some secret thing where it's like, if only you could, but he's, you know, just kind of speculating, like, is there a way we can control this? If we told ourselves, like, no, a donut's good for you. It was his example. And I can't help but think of this. I would admit I'm a cigarette smoker, and every time I look, you know, like a would look at a pack of cigarettes, and it says like this package causes cancer. It's like
you're gonna die.
Right. I'm like, am I killing myself with the cigarettes, or with is this quote unquote warning? Is it only increasing the likelihood that I will?
Yep.
And in just before I moved out of New York last year, they put up these posters in every, it was disgusting, like in every bodega or any place that sold cigarettes, the government of New York City mandated that any place that sold cigarettes had to put up these huge health posters. And it was either like, you know, showing a black lung or showing like rotting teeth or showing like an MRI of like someone who's had a stroke. And it's all these things saying like, if you smoke, this is going to happen to you. And I'll admit that there's a part of me that wonders, is this just my own bullshit desire to want to keep smoking with no ramifications? It's like, oh, don't show me that. I don't want to look at it. But I have to tell you, honestly, is I was like, I don't want to look at that because I feel not like it is this way, but I'm open to the idea that if I tell myself, it's just like going into a psychedelic experience. You could take LSD and start freaking out because your body is going, what the hell did you just do to me? And part of it is to tell your body, no, it's okay. I wanted this. This was a conscious choice. We're doing this on purpose. Don't freak out. And, you know, it's, you know, why, you know, your body might throw up or it's like, you know, thinks it's been poisoned. And you're saying, telling your body, no, this is not poison. I chose to do this. It's cool. I wonder, and again, I'm not going to say, yes, smoking's good. I'm just saying I wonder, the same kind of question is, do we have the control over our health where if I tell my body, no, I'm choosing to smoke this cigarette and I don't need to get cancer or a stroke or any of these things. I don't know if that, you know, how you feel about that, but that's, I'm just letting you know, I've wondered the same thing many, many times.
So I used to be unhealthy, had allergies and all sorts of problems growing up, and whenever that conclusion occurred to me around the same time that I was talking about my tarot card experience before, a lot of stuff changed in my life at that time because I changed my perspective. And since then, I've had the conversation with people who know me, with someone like my mom, where there was a time in the past where she always felt like, this idea is going to catch up with you. Like, you're not taking care of yourself because you're acting like it's just magically taking care of itself. And then I would be like, that's your idea. I'm saying it's not magical. It is taking care of itself. And you're the one that's over there putting yourself in the line of this unhealthy thing through just those. I know for sure that I remember being a kid and lying and saying I was sick to get out of being at school and then being sick by the end of the day.
Uh-huh. Oh, God, yeah. Yeah.
I know that happened for sure. I didn't just make it up. It really happened. So if that's the case, then what's it going to do to me to read the Surgeon General warning through my whole life, every day, always? What's that going to do? And it makes me feel like those people, why do we have an understanding like that? And there are other people that don't. And then that's whenever it brings me back to the fact that it's just different for all of us. And we generalize it and put it over everything, but I don't know.
What you said about being a kid and lying to get out of school, I've thought about that so many times. And I wonder how you feel about this. I've thought maybe it was like the guilt. like, so you lie to your parents and say, like, oh, I don't want to go to school, I can't go to school, I'm really sick, I can't go, and then the fact that by the end of the day you'd be sick, I wondered if, like, did I make myself that way because maybe, I've thought of this as an adult, like, as a kid, do you feel like, oh, I feel bad for lying to my parents, so I'm going to make it true?
Well, look at Mark Golding's story, though.
Yes, yeah.
What was Mark Golding's story? I don't remember.
Well, Mark Golding cleared the... His was the last chapter in the Sync book, too, I think. And he spent a lot of his energy and his effort, his mental consciousness, on a project which was clearing this river that had been clogged up in his neighborhood, so that he had gone on these long walks in his local area and seen this murky, screwed up mess of water that needed to be released. And at the same time that was happening, he had a sick child who was, his son was really sick some way. I don't remember what it was. But he spent a lot of time focusing on wishing that his son was better at the same time that he was consciously putting his hands on these rocks and mud and debris that were clogging up this river, so that whenever the river finally cleared, it was this massive, major relief. In the story, he writes it so well, where he was just...
I remember it now. Yeah.
And then whenever it clears, it's like this big... what was that movie? Spirited Away, whenever she takes the thorn out of the monster's foot, and it's this big, gushing, muddy nastiness. That's what I'm imagining whenever he releases that murky water, and then his son was made better. And through the story, or through what I've seen on his Facebook page, we've communicated a little bitty bit, but I can see that he knows in his heart that he made his son better.
Yeah. That reminds me of ayahuasca. Ayahuasca feels like you find the thing that's, you like lift up a stone, an internal stone or something, and there's like strange worms under it, and you're like, what the fuck is that doing there? And you're like, the realization that it's been there. It's just like a lot of character armor, I think, and defense strategies are put in place, and they work as like blockades to the energy flow. And that, because there's very little basis for comparison, because if you've lived with something that's been instilled for so long, it's hard to even register that it's there. It's like if you have television static and you turn off the TV and all of a sudden it's quiet and you're like, whoa, what just happened? A lot of that kind of thing. There was a man at Burning Man maybe 4 years ago who was giving a talk that Amy and I wandered into the talk. He had had AIDS. He was HIV positive, and he cured himself of AIDS he went to South America and he did a lot of ceremony. And then he went on an all raw diet and did tons and tons of yoga. But then his whole thing was what we're talking about beyond that. He was like, yes, all those things happen, and yes, all those things aided, but the primary thing was my thought approach to what was possible. And so, like, because everyone was telling him this one reality, and so he decided to extract himself completely from that paradigm. And in doing so, the doctors were completely baffled. They could not explain his case, because he was supposed to die, and his partner, he was a homosexual, and his partner did die, which is tragic, you know, but he went on to show people how he went through this healing process, and absolutely incredible. He was talking about pleasure, that we don't get the pleasure from things as we could be. So, like, when he was talking about yoga, it wasn't like a chore or something. Wasn't this like this thing he had to do? He always wanted to do yoga. So every time he would go and do, I'm speaking to asana, so every time he would go to do stretches, he was like excited to do them. He was feeling good about it. It wasn't like this thing, but this burden, you know. And part of that was probably the fact that he just was happy to be alive while he's alive. He was taking what he could out of the life he thought he had left and living it to the fullest, you know.
Right. That's where I think that goes back to what I said way, way earlier about it seeming like we have kind of a misunderstanding. Whenever I think about the doctors that are diagnosing it and the popular thinking about that, it just seems like the people who are the specialists who have done all the studies, they're the ones that should have a clue about this. And I don't know if they do and they just keep it to themselves, or if they have a different train of thought about it and would think that we don't so much affect it that way. I can't tell, because if they did, then you wouldn't have someone like Dr. Oz getting on the TV every day and telling everybody how sick they are.
I know, the fucking wizard. What is that about?
It's crazy. I mean, it's like he's the one spreading the disease, but he's the one that's acting like he's the one there to cure it, and that's what he's doing, is just informing you so you can stay informed and be healthy. But to me, I'm saying they wouldn't be thinking about these things if you weren't sitting there talking about it, and now that you've done that, you're giving them the plague.
Totally.
But I can't tell sometimes if I'm just getting all paranoid about it. And
oh, it's probably both.
Yeah, I have a similar thought about Alex Jones. You know, there's a lot of course, there's a lot of theories out there that Alex Jones is controlled opposition or whatever, or an agent or a blah, blah, blah. To me, it doesn't really matter. I just think he's a loud, obnoxious guy, you know. But what I think is so interesting, they have this, what is their slogan? Is something like, there's a war on your mind, right? And I think, what is that? And I could very easily see how it could be an intentional psyop or neuro-linguistic programming, but even if it's not meant to be, it certainly acts as such. That every day you're saying there's a war on your mind means you're constantly thinking about war. Not, you know, so he's saying, you know, they're trying to get inside your head. But what he's doing is getting inside your head and making you constantly fixated on war, death, violence, guns, you know, police data. And I'm not saying that these are things we shouldn't be concerned about. What I'm saying is, if there's a war always on your mind, you are going to destroy yourself.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Absolutely. You got to get out of that, and we're not doing any good to reinforce that type of generalization when there's two ways that you could generalize it, you know? So it's lame. We call it facts, and we talk about it like we know what we're talking about, and yet there are these people that defy the odds. Well, why aren't they the fact then, you know? So if everyone's going to die from smoking cigarettes, and it's going to be so important that we all need to keep informed so that we don't die from smoking cigarettes, well, what about that 100-year-old man that's been smoking a pack a day for the past 50 years?
Yeah, that's my grandma.
I know that he's not that common, but there he is. He's that one guy that does it, and that one guy that does it makes me think, I want to be like him, no. Not the one that dies.
There's more than him, but they've proven why that's so. That's been documented many times over. And so there's something to do with, first of all, you're obviously like what we're saying of energetic openness to positivity, right? But they've shown that consistency with specifically with tobacco makes a huge difference, because your lungs actually have a coping kind of strategy that's built in biologically, so that once your body realizes that, okay, this is the new thing that you're having to process, it builds like a layer of mucoid kind of stuff around your lungs, which this is why they found that people who start and stop and start and stop are far more affected than the people who just smoke at some consistent rate and maintain that throughout their lives. So like my grandmother, she started smoking before she was like even 13 years old, right? Non-filter Camels and Pall Malls and Lucky Strikes and those kind of things, you know. And I met her when she was in her 90s, and she's smoking like a chimney. It's ultimately what killed her, but my God, that's a long time to be.
That's a long life too. Like, she'd been, whenever it's time to die, if you get the chance to be in your 90s, then you've outdone most people.
Yeah, and I felt it was just like, she was so, there was no question about it. She never questioned what she was doing. She did that, and she just maintained that. I'm not that type. I go and there's off also, and on, you know.
But there's also other health issues there, too, because I have a great-grandmother that was, I think she went to be 88 years old, which, of course, is funny, Back to the Future, but great-grandmother, and I remember every time, she smoked unfiltered Camel cigarettes, like, nonstop. And that's my only memory of this woman, is her sitting in this kitchen in my grandmother's house, It was my grandmother's mother sitting in this little kitchen in an apartment, and you would just go in there, and she'd just be smoking. And you'd go in there, and you'd hang out with her for a few minutes, and then you'd leave, and then you'd go back in, and she'd just smoke, and she just sat there and smoked. 88 years old, and why didn't that kill her? But you got to figure, when she was a growing up, she didn't have processed foods. You know, so eating healthier her whole life, not because, I don't know what her diet was like as a 30-year-old woman, but even an unhealthy diet at that time was not the same kind of unhealthy diet we have now. Do you know what I mean? Like, she's not eating heavily processed foods, GMOs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. She probably ate a lot of fruits and vegetables and whatever, grains and whatever was there, but it wasn't the same kind of stress on their body. And even, you know, I can look at my family and see complete drastic differences in the health of the older generation versus the newer generation, where on my mom's side, my grandmother is very, very healthy, but she worked on a farm her whole life. You know, she probably ate really well and did constantly outdoors working and all this sort of stuff. My great grandmother on my dad's side, chain smoking to 88. All these different things. Then you look at said.
Grew up in a time when you didn't have it.
Right. And all the additives probably weren't in there. That's what I'm saying. It's like all these other things that are being thrown at you, or all these other factors are in there as well. So it just amazes me when you look at the baby boom generation, how many of them are really unhealthy, and it's like that drastic difference where we went from the older generation that was eating healthier, that was not eating processed foods, and then this just drastic jump in one generation to like severe obesity and cancer rates and all this sort of stuff.
I recently lost a friend to cancer who had one of the defining traits of our relationship was our constant conversation about the benefits of veganism versus non-veganism. He took care of himself in all ways, and he was always trying to spread the word that everyone's not taking care of themselves, and he's the one that ended up in his coffin. And then I sit over here where I eat the processed foods, but my philosophy in my own head, for me personally, I can't tell anyone else how to live their life, but I'm on this trip where I'm trying my hardest to come to terms with my part in reality with those synchronicities that we're here to talk about, and my part in my conscious part in my reality, so that whenever I talk about lying myself into being sick when I'm a little kid, I pay attention to that as being something that I was actually somehow expressing myself. And there's parts of it that I'm not conscious of that are just doing it, but there's a lot of it that I can control. And I control that by sometimes trying to kid myself. I listen to the stuff like the philosophy that like you were talking about earlier about the cigarettes building up a tolerance in your lungs. And I'm like, if I can convince myself of that, then I can live longer. So it doesn't matter what the common consensus is. I think the cigarettes are going to give me a callus in my lungs. And not only will they make it so that I can handle more cigarettes better, but they'll also make it where I can handle the pollution in my whole environment better. But that goes against the common sense, and people would look at me like, "Oh yeah, well, whatever it takes to make you feel okay, you know." But right. Then, so far, so good.
Right.
I'll question that when I have a reason to.
Yeah, I think that there is actually a legitimate argument in this case when it comes to actual studies, and most people who cite it would more often than not be using those studies as a rationalization, especially in terms of adaptivity. Like you're saying, in terms of pollution and stuff, you are building a protective layer around your lungs, which is that healthy? You know, I don't think so necessarily, but there's circumstances, you know.
It's my vitamins, man.
I have to admit, I feel the same. Like, I've just been able to notice, and again, so this is not from like a consciousness perspective. I'm thinking of it as, David, I'm totally open to this being just me justifying my actions. I'm totally open to that. But what I'm going to say is that I smoke, and I grew up in New York, highly polluted. Michael, I know you're in L.A., right? I don't know how long you've lived there, but tons of pollution there. And I remember, like, when my wife first moved to New York, she was getting sick all the time. She would constantly had a cold or a fever or something. And I'm like, why are you always sick? Because she wasn't used to it. And it just, like, I barely ever have a cold or anything. And it just made me realize that I don't know if it's, you know, drinking a little bit of poison all the time makes you immune to it or what it is. But, again, I'm really not trying to justify. I'm just putting that out there as it's something that I've definitely noticed. So,
I mean, to me, that's where this conversation is so wonderful. We don't have to, you wouldn't have to, it's society's want to have us worried about what we're justifying, you know, like the culture around us. We're raised to reconsider these things so that we can be straight in our head and make the right decisions based on what they're telling us. And I'm trying to say that they don't really understand it. They're saying they do, but they don't. I think, you know, like I say, I got to clear it all up with me saying I don't know either, and I'm talking all this like I do. I start acting like, while I'm saying it, it comes out like I don't know, like I'm acting like I'm ahead of the game or something. I don't think I am. I'm just another person. But I think that the more we fall for the old ways of being, the more we're just going to keep on being that way. And so far, I don't know, it wasn't working for me.
Right, like those Jack LaLanne guys, like the guy who exercised all the time and always ate right and then died of a heart attack at 40.
Mm-hmm.
You know, did he, was it because he was constantly worried about getting sick?
I go to Whole Foods and see a lot of sick people.
Yeah.
And Whole Foods is supposed to be where all the people are at to get to stay healthy. So you'd think you go in there and everybody be glowing. Instead, there are a bunch of pale people that are looking for help.
That's a generalization, but
I
think there's some truth to it. And you could argue that a lot of people who are eating at health food situations are trying to make up for a past. And it's one thing if you're raised with something, but to undergo a complete shift like that in lifestyle, I think it can be kind of traumatic on your body. The extremism that a lot of times goes into it. Yeah, people don't usually make those kind of transitions smoothly.
Right. Well, we don't need extremes one way or the other anyhow. So we know that there's something to that. You got to have a balance. And that whenever I sit there and I start talking about it like it's all in our head and stuff, then I know while I'm saying it, I say it out loud because that sounds a lot better than trying to explain that some of it's in our head and some of it's not. Or it just feels better for me trying my hardest to convince myself that it goes beyond what it is that I grew up on, what it is that my mom is teaching me.
Well, that's how the pendulum works, right? Because you go into one extreme and almost inevitably you want to go to the other.
You swing right in the middle and you're back on the other side.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that happens, you know. Everybody does that to some extent in their own ways, you know.
That's why they call it yo-yo dieting, right?
Right.
Well, it's fro-yo dieting.
So, Michael, let's switch this a little bit back to your art for a second. I'm just focusing on this because I think it's really, really, really interesting. But you do a lot of video work, not just the ionosphere, but just using that as a kind of anchor point here. The fact that you would put a helmet on and have someone project that you're now projecting your images into someone, either what, you know, we could take this as what is the artistic responsibility then of what you're projecting at people, or we could also take this as how do we start to, you know, kind of what you were saying now, how do we project our own reality?
I know that from the start, there's always been this kind of time where I can feel like I'm getting myself in a zone. And I think that we share it with everybody else, so everyone's getting in their own, like, that zone. What I don't know how to define it except for saying you're in the zone, you're in the flow. It's that thing where you are wishing that it would be that way, and then whenever it starts clicking, then you let it happen. Sometimes I experience that with my visuals where I have certain nights where nothing seems like it goes together. There are some nights where I stand there for 3 or 4 hours mixing videos and trying to find something that looks right with the music that's playing, and I just can't hit it right. And I'll sit there all night just kind of like grumpy about the fact that I can't get a hit. But then there are other nights where all night it just seems like I'm a magician and all I have to do is point at the screen and all of a sudden it's speaking directly to me in the music that I'm playing. And sometimes it seems like that has to do with all the people that are in the room, like we're all doing it together or something. Sometimes it seems like maybe that zone that I'm talking about, maybe it is just the fall of the dice, but it seems like there's coincidence whenever they're for real and they break the odds, I can tell that I was feeling right about that, you know? I can't say it's been that way forever, but it gets that way these days.
I think about what we do here as far as looking at synchronicities and noticing this and opening, as David said, like opening yourself up to these possibilities. It's almost like a mental yoga in a way of getting yourself into that space where the zone comes more easily. I don't know if you guys would agree with that, but
I feel
like
big time.
It's been a big influence on me.
Like reading, if I'm reading the right books, then I sit there and I see it happen, and then it fades away when I'm finished with that book. So there's something going on where I get in the zone if I'm listening to the right podcast, and if I have the right day where we listen to the right thing and I go away from it with my mind thinking that way, then it's like an explosion around me. Everything is in sync, and then that'll fade away, and I'll be back in the normal world that I expect, where it just is. It's not a matter of me putting these things together, you know. But a lot of what we're talking about also is so individual, because it just has to do with me and myself and what I'm thinking of. Maybe while I'm watching the White Horse up there and listening to the DJ play the White Horse, there's still certain people out there that would just look up at it and just completely not put the two together and just say, I don't care. It doesn't matter if it's saying about the White Horse instead of the White Horse. It still doesn't mean anything because the two of them don't go together. And I do that a lot in my world where I put it all together and say, oh, wow, I'm turning the key at the same time the music's going off. Oh, wow, it's amazing. Oh, wow, they're talking about what I was reading about, you know? These are the things I pay attention to in my world, and I think that attention, I can't say that it makes it more that way, but I know that there's times where I feel like I've done my exercises.
Sure, I think it's like when you're this idea that if you're looking for something, you're going to find it. To me, again, I'm very weary of that sort of self-help secret idea of I'm very open to laws of attraction, but not as explicitly as someone trying to sell you, if you want a sports car, you just think about it and you'll get it.
Look at what happened to the guy that was all pinning it on his wall. The guy that those people died in the sweat camp, sweat lodge or whatever.
Right.
It's like, I know the secret. I'm going to tell all of you about it. And now I'm going to sit in jail for the rest of my life because I accidentally killed some people.
Right.
That.
Right. I guess you didn't mean to manifest that one.
Yeah, something went wrong.
But at the same time, I'm open to certain aspects of that. And I think about when you say, is it something that the people aren't even going to notice that the White Horse happened at the same time? There's a few things that can happen there. One is, especially I think this happens a lot with conspiracies, is that someone who would notice it would assume it's intentional. Oh, okay, there's a video artist and there's a band playing. They lined it up that way.
Yeah, that's the most common way of looking at it.
Right, so if you notice it, then you might just attribute intentionality to it. Then the other side is that, like you said, just someone who wouldn't even recognize it if it was happening. And that's why I feel like Carl Jung has this idea, this phrase, he says, synchronicity is an ever-present reality for those... I don't know if it's for those with eyes to see it or something like that. And it's this idea that, of course, it's always there. I remember just walking down the street in New York all the time, and I would just sort of walk face forward. And when my wife moved there, she kept saying, you realize how much change people drop on the floor? And I was like, no. So I started walking, looking down at the ground. And there was a ton of fucking money on the floor. And I'm like, what is up with this? Now, did I make that happen? Was it probably always there? It's the same thing as, we forget to look up and look at the stars and look at the beauty of the world. So I think we've gotten to a mindset where we're always kind of walking around with blinders on or so focused on one thing that we don't notice so much of the world around us, that we forget to look up at the beauty, we forget to look down at the gutter, or sometimes there's treasure in the gutter, forget to look in all directions. And I think this is just hopefully what we're doing here is trying to remind ourselves and others who listen to this stuff or read the books, but I really feel like it's reminding ourselves constantly that don't forget to keep looking around and being open to these things.
Well, with technology, with my visuals, the technology has evolved so much in the past 10 years that there are completely new ways for me to gain access to this content that didn't exist 10 years ago. So, for instance, nowadays I can use like a Google Chromecast and I can do live visuals where I'm surfing YouTube real time on a big screen, big 40-foot screen in front of the room. And this gives me access to the like international database of videos that I normally would have no access to. And now all of a sudden I find myself in a chain of links that are these Russian animations. And I can't even read what it says about it, but I'm just going based on the keyframe. And then all of a sudden I hit the one that's perfect. It's exactly what I wish I was playing right now while the DJ's playing what he's playing. And I find that even though that's the case, that control of it has kind of taken away from what I used to do, where I would just completely randomly hit play on something and let it fall together. And I feel like there was more beauty in that. Whenever the two things had no idea that they were going to fall together, then that made me feel that warm feeling in my heart that I'm going for a lot more than being able to push a button and pull it up.
Yeah. And that feels like the edge of glory, right? You're like on the edge of something because you're not seeing where you're not in a position where there's a safeguard. So like you don't know where something's going to go or how something's going to land. And the thrill of that makes you feel like you're more a part of the creation than you would otherwise.
Just hitting a key and pulling up. That's, I mean, so, in so many ways, that's just, it's cooler. It's neater. It's awesome. You know, and if I can hit a button and I'm like, oh, there's the white horse. And then I hit my button and pull up the white horse. Well, what's so cool about that? You know, like if I had my white horse programmed over here and he's playing the white horse, it's not that awesome for you to be able to generate the white horse whenever you got a big pile with all your horses and rabbits and people lined up.
So you're talking about that track that's like Ride the White Horse. That's like a woman singing.
No, it's a deep voice. Oh. If you want. Ride, then ride the white horse.
Oh, that is a guy. Okay. you know what that song's actually about?
Coke, right?
Yeah, it's about cocaine. The white horse is code for coke, supposedly.
Right.
I just, it's been said so many times, I just want to put it out there.
Yeah, no, we've been on I used to say the sun all the time, because there's another song that was, my life in the sunshine. And every time I'd hear the sunshine song, the sunshine would pop up. Mm-hmm. But the white horse is one that's like, It's just not general enough. It's just exact enough that whenever that, I've had the experience more than once in my life with that same song. So there's been more than once that song was being played and I looked up. Now, usually I am looking at four or five videos playing at one time. So I'm looking around my room at everything that's going on. But if I can look up at the four screens and find that thing that ties in with it specifically, then I feel like I'm experiencing that magical side of reality that some people can deny it, but I feel like it's real.
Totally. I played all of Holy Mountain one time with my friend had his laptop set up with all these different effects and things. And so there's a crossfader just like there is with music. I'm not telling you, I'm telling the audience. So I can go in between and throw just a whole slew of effects on the Holy Mountain, Alejandro Jodorowsky. And, oh man, there was just like through the whole fucking thing, I could see how different things were applicable to what was going on. And, but it didn't do the thing like, it was like for every 10 things, there's like one that lands. Yep. And it's noteworthy. But like with film syncs, I'm after where it's like 9 out of 10. Like, right. That's what I want to see, and I have a desire to see that because I know that it's possible. And you're like, well, out of all these things, I'm pulling one thing out, and yes, it's significant, but I want the complete fucking overload, which is something I've never gotten from just VJing, though I have gotten really excited at the degree and the surprise of how much alignment can happen just on its own. It is pretty incredible.
Well, just like on my Wall of Oz video, if you look at the YouTube link, underneath it, I've gone through and wrote down my time codes for my favorite scenes, which are all over the place. It goes from the front to the beginning, or from the beginning to the end. But I've talked to some people who will watch it for 15, 20 minutes and be like, I just can't handle this as being one thing. There's no way for me to close my mind to the fact that the audio has nothing to do with the video, and so it's not as entertaining to me or interesting to me as it is to you. Me having watched it 20,000 times probably in my life and totally have memorized the lyrics or every word to the Wizard of Oz because of how many times I've watched this thing, I can go in and pick my favorite parts out and say, okay, this works and this works and this works and this works. Other people might see it and disagree with me, but for me, I'm saying this is why it works so well together. And as a VJ, I'm trying to do that as much as I possibly can. So I want to get a continual flow of that as a VJ. I can't expect that when I'm just hitting play on two movies together. But if I'm triggering the next clip and I see that that clip A is not working anymore, then I hope that I have something else lined up real quick so I can jump right over to it.
I noticed on your Wall of Oz YouTube video, you have a bunch of time codes in the description. I thought that was really cool to kind of point out, like, where, for someone who might just find it on the internet and not really know what they're looking at, there's a bunch of time codes to be like, hey, look at this. Hey, look at this.
That's so, because some people will overlook at least like 50, 90% of what I'm seeing. They would look at it and totally not see it unless I was sitting there talking about it to them. And then it's almost like I'm trying to convince them it's in sync whenever it might not be. So I'm over there trying to teach them what goes together and what doesn't. And that's not what it's about, you know?
Yeah, I think there's a really nice middle ground is instead of like trying to teach someone, you know, or convince someone, you just point and go, isn't that interesting?
Right. So I had Joe Alexander here the other day, and I showed him Lars von Trier film Antichrist with Charlotte Gainsbourg's album that she came out. So the actress in the film Antichrist produced an album very shortly after the film came out with Beck. And so I play that album with the film, and it is an example of a flawless sync. But a lot of the symbolism in the film in the first place and what she's communicating in the music is overtly, as far as I can tell, and I feel like there's an extremely strong argument for it, very Kabbalistic. So there's a lot of Jewish mysticism in the film and in the music. And there was examples of things that are very basic in Kabbalah that Joe wasn't familiar with. And so we're watching the movie, and I could not tell him when the chestnuts are falling or when the nuts are falling from the trees that that's representing the klipot, and that literally they show you the tree of life on the window, and he reaches under the window, and you can see like what they're symbolically communicating. For me, it's very overt, but for him, because he hasn't studied it, it's like, I see that it goes in sync, but what is actually being communicated? And so I'm sure that there's more than what I'm taking from it. And I'm sure there's things I'm seeing in it that aren't intentionally there, but I feel like there's a strong argument for things that I'm seeing that are most likely intentionally there. And so it was helpful for me to point those things out. I would like more to not have to do it during the presentation, but have it all laid out from the get-go so they can approach it through that. Then again, if I explain something in 5, 10, 20 minutes, it's not going to do the justice of something that one has studied for a few years, like I'm sure Lars von Trier did when he believed he was Jewish before he found out he was German, you know, and Charlotte Gainsbourg is Jewish, you know, that's a Jewish name, even though she's from France. Her father is Jewish and she's Jewish, and so you can see the influence there. Even IRM seems to be a play on Ayin Resh Mem, which is, it's supposed to be an MRI backwards, but it spells out the Hebrew word for naked, which is also the same word for cunning or deception. So the serpent in the garden, it's one of my favorite two verses because they're side by side and they have the same word with two different meanings. So introduce the serpent, the most cunning of all the creatures in the garden, very next verse, or maybe strike that, reverse it, I guess, but these verses are side by side. Adam and Eve were naked and were not ashamed. The word for naked is the same word for cunning, and that is the name of the album if you translate it into English to go with this film Antichrist, which is all about a clephotic version of the Garden of Eden. And so it's a total trip, but I have to qualify what I'm showing him. I'm like, here, I'm going to show you something cool. You should know this first, you know.
And who knows what's happening in the world, but my take on it is that you and what you're searching for while you're searching for it. You're influencing it, and it's real, and it's really happening. And maybe maybe they did intentionally do it, but maybe that all happens at the same time that you discover what you're looking for. So maybe our reality wouldn't unfold that way if you wouldn't have thought along that train of thought, and then that maybe helped pull that into being with you.
It's possible, and that isn't Occam's razor. Occam's razor with certain examples, like I'm not saying, you know, I'm saying the degree to which it aligns, which if you watch it, it's like, fuck, it doesn't stop. Like, it's like this through the whole thing, even when you loop the album, and it becomes more and more applicable as the film goes on, and things that aren't vague. Like, you know how, like, if you read a astrology reading in a newspaper, you can see how they purposely put things out that are just vague enough so that it'll be applicable to just about whoever reads it, you know? This is an example where it's transcended that. This is not just a matter of, like, generality. This is, like, very fucking specific. And so that's why, like, it's like an example of something where I've gotten to the point where I'm like, yes, I will consider that this is, like, what you just said, I do not deny as a possibility. And there's certain cases where I've gotten to the point where I'm like, that isn't actually Occam's razor. Occam's razor in this example would actually say that this is done on the part of the artist, and that things do, there is a way that things align with archetypes and all these things, but they're almost using that fact and then going the next mile with it is the more rational.
They're having a good playing with it while they're creating something.
Yeah.
But, you know, David, what happens when you use Occam's razor to cut up your white horse?
I don't know. You'll have to look in the mirror that's cut up on.
Of course you're going to do it on a mirror, right? It's still going to reflect back to you.
Right.
Right. I had a whole Godfather picture in my head, a horse in the bed and all this stuff. God. So I didn't even take it the mirror direction whenever you said it. I was like, you're going to cut up the horse?
Wasn't
when he said that the white horse is a reference to cocaine, I'm saying you use a razor to cut up your cocaine on a mirror. So if we're trying to dissect the synchronicity of a horse sync with using Occam's razor, it's got to be done on a mirror.
Was that a when the horse's head is found in the bed in Godfather, is that a reference to Red Rum? Because Red Rum was one of the most famous racehorses that's ever lived, you know, is like huge winning racehorse. I thought that was so weird that like Kubrick did The Killing about killing a racehorse, and then here in The Godfather you have this, like, I don't know, I'm connecting, I'm playing psychedelic synchronicity hopscotch, but
sounds like fun.
It is kind of weird.
It is pretty fun.
Whenever I was a kid, my grandmother used to always say that I was a really lucky kid. She would always really put all these messages in my head that I was like luckier than everybody else. And she would sit there and watch me play solitaire, and I would win a few times in a row, and I wouldn't be cheating or anything. I would just, the cards would unfold for me so that I'd win. And she'd say, I've seen you win 3 times today, kid, and I haven't won in the past 20 years of me playing it. You're magical. You're amazing. And then at one point, I was going to these skateboard competitions, and they would raffle off free skateboards at the end of the thing. I was like in the fifth, sixth grade. And one time I'm standing in line with my grandmother, and she's telling the lady behind us, this kid's so lucky. Yeah, your kid doesn't even need to pick a raffle card because my kid's going to win it. And she said it with such confidence that I remember her looking at the lady, and I remember her kind of laughing like, yeah, she's just playing with this lady, pulling a chain or whatever. And then I win the skateboard deck. I'm like, aha. And I remember my grandmother looking at the lady like, hey, I told you, see? Mm-hmm. Well, then the next week I go to a skateboard competition, and she's not with me, but it's just me by myself. But I do the same thing. I win a raffle. I win a skateboard raffle so that I had won 2 skateboards 2 weeks in a row from just random raffle tickets. And I've always thought that that was because she was, as a little kid, I was real influenceable, and that part of me that's a part of reality, she was tugging it around and giving it these positive messages that made me believe in myself in a way that I don't really even understand that I believe in myself. And it made me like do do something that I don't understand how to do, but my subconscious was what was doing it, so that everything fell into line to make what I thought was going to happen happen. And that's how I made that make sense, that such an irrational thing would happen, because it doesn't make sense for me to have randomly drawn the ticket twice, which is what I did. And that makes sense to me. And then whenever I look at all of these crazy, coincidental, insane line, the way things line up and juxtapose and all that stuff, it seems to me like we're doing it in different ways, you know. Instead of trying to draw the ticket, you're trying to find the pattern. And sometimes you find the pattern, and then you can show everybody and say, hey, I really found it. But it was just because you didn't know what you were doing, and that part that does know can do whatever the hell it wants. Boundless.
Yeah.
So that's kind of my take on the whole synchronicity thing. That's why I stay so fascinated with it, and why I feel like it's so hard for us to describe or explain, because that encompasses everything. So while you're doing that, you might be able to find out, yeah, Roger Waters did do it. They were sitting there planting cookies and everything that they did, and we're finding them 50 years later, because we happen to have the CD players to make it possible for us to pause it and rewind it and forward it appropriately. But that still ties right in with the mystical idea that you made it happen.
Right.
Because everything can be explained.
Right. How is it that I just realized, so I was really stoked on the fact that I feel that I actually found a intentional sync with the Summer of 42 and Adam Hart Mother, and then I just struck me that it is 42 years after Summer of 42 came out, exactly, that I figured it out. And so I was like, wow, that's
awesome. Yeah,
it took 42 years, I guess. I don't know who else has stumbled on that one.
For the fish to open your mind. Look at the symbols. While I was reading my Valis, this guy came up. I read the part that's talking about the fish symbol opening his mind, and I take my mind all the way there, where I'm thinking about it a lot, about the symbols, the swastika, how it's been covered up from us, and the different, you know, the pentagram and all these images. They have all these weird associations with them and make us like avoid it. So same way that I would say earlier, I don't pay much attention to Crowley because I'm staying off the dark side. I don't pay much attention to pentagrams either because I stay off the other trip because I was raised in the South, and I don't really, those rules don't apply to me at all, but I still got my upbringing in my soul, you know? And so that night, this guy comes up, I'm reading that part about in Valis, and this guy with this black long hair, looked like he was a member of Danzig or something. He comes up with this pentagram and an upside down cross on his neck. And I was working at a club, and we went into this whole conversation of him trying to explain to me that everybody just associates this symbol with something bad, and that it's not bad per se. It just is what it is, and people are afraid of it, and they shouldn't be because it's real magical. And that kind of synchronicity, like, that was real meaningful to me. The fact that I had my eyes open to something that they had always been closed to, and then it went on to my next experience.
Yeah.
It wasn't just that, just the book didn't make me think it, but then the conversation after I read the book in the same night made me think even further along that same thought process, you know?
Totally.
Yeah. Fun stuff, yeah. Synchronicity.
I've had a lot of aversion to... I gave myself a tarot reading every day for over 6 years, with very, very little exception. And for probably, I don't know, maybe 2 of those years, I used the Rider deck. And for the rest of the time, I used the Thoth Crowley deck. And the whole fucking time, for the most part, was going back and forth regularly with an aversion to right. Crowley, while I was reading book after book of Crowley. And I found that the thing that kept me going was the fact that I was trying to come to terms with something, not just coming to terms like rationalizing something, but wanting to understand, like, what is what and where is where, and I don't want to just have an aversion of something due to a superstition or due to a judgment or due to a fear. If I have an aversion to something, I want it to be because there's an actual necessity for that. And so because I had such a charge on it, particularly with the way I was raised and things, I found that it actually drove me to go deeper than I could have otherwise. So the fact that there was so much stigma, it was the stigma itself, because of my relationship to that stigma, it was the driving force to continuing on with my study. And so,
that's so much stuff, man. That totally gets my perspective in line with, like, I like what you're saying there, because I have always just kind of been like, well, maybe I don't need it, because I've always kind of not paid attention to it. So, you know, even though I've listened to so much of you guys talking over the past few months and heard that, you know, I can tell that it's not like, I don't know, it's not evil. It's not like it's going to like make me turn all dark and scary, but I still never picked it up like I did Nietzsche, right, which I stay away from intentionally because of what it says.
Sure.
So whenever I read Nietzsche, then that made me feel like, no, I don't want to do this to myself. I'm going to, or just like the other day, like I said, I watched Gigi Allen for like 2 hours the other day on YouTube, came out feeling completely disturbed and messed up. Like, I need help just for thinking about doing what I did to myself just now.
Yeah.
But I did it intentionally because I was like, now face it, you know, face this, you can take it.
Sure. Yeah, Nietzsche all comes down to the lamb. So when he was a little kid and he saw his neighbor with his son watching slaughtering a lamb in a storm, mm-hmm. and that he saw that there, that in the man who was killing the lamb and in the child's relationship to it, that there was absolutely no judgment, no right and wrong, no anything other than necessity. Because they weren't killing the lamb out of anger. They weren't killing the lamb out of anything other than need. And so that set him on his road, just like Jim Morrison supposedly coming across dead Indians scattered across a highway in his youth deeply affected him, and he had to reconcile it. So you can see what some people could look at as trauma, others relate to as a something that's got their wheels rolling, so that they had to get to the bottom of something. And if that never,
Siddhartha did the same thing, right?
Isn't
the story of Siddhartha seeing the home or seeing a dead person on the road and asking the driver what the purpose was behind that, and the driver not really having an answer for it, and that set him out on his quest to become the Buddha?
Right. He didn't realize that everybody was keeping him from something up until that point. He was like, what are you hiding from me? You're hiding something from me? What are you hiding? Oh, death? What is that? Like, yeah. That's shelter, being sheltered, you know.
So he was sheltered. He wasn't scared. He wasn't seeing it and thinking, oh, no, that's graphic, bloody horror, which is what Nietzsche and Morrison would have been experiencing. Well, because for the Morrison story, like, I just picture, I turn my head away from car accidents when we drive past them, because I never want to see the things that you can, like, accidentally print into your brain whenever you drive past that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It seems like Morrison did it at the right age so that it stuck with him for the rest of his life.
Yeah. Well, he was considering in the midst of it another level, like he could kind of, like, peer under it of what's taking place. You know, like, I mean, I sat with a dying raccoon one time that I hit with my car, and I could see that moment where it crossed over, you know, and it didn't go anywhere. It wasn't like anything actually disappeared. It just went, it just dispersed. It, like, was holding on to an energy, and then the energy was released. But there was no point where it ended and its environment began. It was just, like, focalized energy, you know? And so I think that's the part of the meaning of, there's a reason why, like, if you listen to An American Prayer, the album that came out after his death, that it goes from the dead Indians on Dawn's Highway, it goes from Dawn's Highway to Blood in the Streets. So it translates over. So when he's looking at the Indian that becomes a hitchhiker in his own body, right? It goes from that to blood in the streets of the town of New Haven, blood stains the roofs and the palm trees of Venice, blood, my love in the terrible summer, bloody red sun up, fantastic LA, is that he looks around at LA growing up and realizes that it's built on blood. And so, and that we don't want to look at that. We have an aversion to facing what we're building on top of, because every empire is built on the empire previous. And though the Indians weren't necessarily an empire by any normal sense of the term, we're still building on their land, and that they're in the land, they're in the soil, they're in the earth, you know, just like the dinosaurs didn't go anywhere, you know, or they're in us, you know.
See that site that talks about the people dancing the ghost dance in the Pyramid Lake?
Yeah. Well,
that's pretty fascinating stuff.
Totally. I cannot not think of that every time I go to Burning Man and ride the snake to the lake, the ancient lake. I'm on my way to the ancient lake.
Yeah. Like, yeah. I'm not familiar with what you guys are talking about. What's that?
Pyramid Lake was a site of one of the biggest massacres of Indians in California, or not California, in Nevada. And it was like a huge, it was just a crazy slaughter. And so they're throwing parties now on the land where these Indians were killed. So
Indians together and dance around a massive fire. So they were trying to ward off the evil presence of the white man that was killing off their society, because there is one teacher who brought him to this place from all over the nation to try to, he told him, if you will dance around this fire, then there will be more of you than there are buffalo on the land.
Right.
And then they came and slaughtered him. So while they were all coming together to try to make this death go away, they were out there dancing, and the white man came and just was popping them off, killed a whole bunch of them all at one time, so that guy had to go into seclusion because he felt responsible for calling together all these people that got killed because they didn't have guns. And the guys with the guns came in and just killed them all. Well, now we go out there in the same vicinity and dance around this fire, and there's some real tribal shit going on out there, man. Whenever you hang out for a little bit, it gets real, like, it's almost like somehow you're seeing older generations through us modern people that are walking around out there.
I believe that as clueless as a lot of people approach Pyramid Lake, that in the midst of that, there's some release taking place. There's some purpose behind it. Mm-hmm. It is not just a fucking desecration. I refuse to accept that that's all that it is, though I do feel that there is, because of the degree of unconsciousness, that element is there. But I feel like in the midst of that, there's something very important happening.
Think of all the people that are doing their ceremonies out there and crossing over into places mentally that I don't do the stuff that I do out there the rest of the year, never have. And then I go out there every year and just kind of open up in a way that it feels like they're, you know, it gets real far out mentally. Like, the more you think about it and talk about it, the more wonky it all seems. But sometimes it seems like a communion between the Indians and us. Like, they're like, maybe we are those thousands of Indians that are going to be in. Maybe we are those people where there will be more of them than there are buffalo. Well, we're walking around out there with the paint on our face and feathers in our hair, just the same that they did, passing around our peace pipes and dancing around the fire, just like they were.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It reminds me of, like, I look at a lot of what's out there when I'm moving, when I'm riding through it, especially, like, that, even especially, like, on the playa, that there's almost, like, a stagnancy that's there that we're, like, stirring up and trying to release a flow. Like, it feels like every time I go there that there's something there that, like, is just there all the time. And it's, like, almost just waiting for some movement to stir it up. It's weird.
It is really weird, because that's exactly how I feel. And, like I say, one year I went really on that tangent where I couldn't stop thinking of it. And I was seeing all these people, and it just seemed like a bunch of tribes out there. And it seemed like we were doing something that was just, I mean, at one point some fortune teller, palm reader came up to our camp, and it made me feel like, and then this other guy that had to, at the same time, okay, the fortune teller comes up to the camp. I'm already on this trip where I'm like, well, here we got another Indian from a neighborhood camp or something coming up to read our fortunes. And then this guy comes up who had some sort of a bone degeneration disease where he was sitting there in pain the whole time that we talked to him, man. He was like Minnie in Ballas, dude. And we were sitting there and he was like grinding. He was grunting with pain while he was talking to us. And you could see it in his face, man. He was going through something. I've never been through what he was going through. He was living in it, man. And it really, all of it just made me feel like I was seeing some sort of another time in front of me, even though I was living it, walking around, and it was like, this is from a long time ago, not right now. I don't know. None of that would probably make sense to anyone except for me in my own head with the pain.
No, I understand. I've but it was ancient, ancient yeah. something. Yeah. No.
I think we're sitting here kind of contemplating that because I'm sure we've all had that sort of strange. It's not something you can really explain well, or certainly not, you know, very rationally. But I think we all sort of understand where you're coming from.
You know, the first 4 years I went out there, while setting up, the first song I heard on the playa 4 years in a fucking row was The End.
And my
first year I was overdosed by like five hits, and I thought I was taking one hit and I took six, and it was my first day on the playa after the night before. I've been up for 3 days setting up for
2007?
What's that?
Did you say that was in 2007?
Yeah, 2007.
So you got there whenever the eclipse was happening.
I arrived, I set up my tent, I ate a handful of mushrooms, I went for a walk. On the way to the playa, these two English guys stopped me, and they were like, come in this tent, we want you to fuck these two women, we want a three-way on film right now, let's do it. And I was like, at first I didn't believe them. I was like, are you guys going to just fucking rob me or something? Like, what is this? And I look in the tent and there's two naked women. And I was like, oh, far out. But I was just like, I've never been to Burning Man before. I'm like, okay, I get the idea. That's what this place is. Okay, I'm coming up on mushrooms. I don't want to do this right now. And then I walk into the playa, and while I'm peeking, that's when I see the full lunar eclipse, and I look over, and the man's on fire, and people are riding past me going, what does this mean? What does this mean? And then it was so the next day I get overdosed, and I walk out to the temple. For the first time I'd ever been to the temple, I block out all the words. This is just my immediate response of how to work with the temple, and I just pick one thing at random on the wall, and I just read it to myself over and over again because I'm extremely high. And it's signed Jim Morris, and it says something along the lines of, you know I have always been there for you. You know I have always done everything I can do. Please forgive me for those dreams I was unable to make real. And it said, Dear Quest was how it started. Huh. And then it ended with Jim Morris. And I had Aleister Crowley's The Book of the Law in my pocket. And I took it out, and I... like fell to my knees. Like I'd never been pulled to the earth before in my life. Like I literally like fell to my knees and I just started fucking rocking back and forth. And this woman behind me was crying, and she was crying and crying and crying and crying. 'Cause this is a temple, you know, everyone's writing to loved ones who have passed. And so like, I just fucking started bawling. And then I could like come up out of it and see my emotional body, like as an energy, like an energy field. And I looked down at the book, and I looked up at the thing that I read, and out of this came, like a year later or something, the inclination to take the first section of the book in the law and to cross-weave it. It's a Kabbalistic tool that my teacher has shown me to do with text, that they, you know, traditionally somewhat do, you know, rabbis have done this, where you take two pieces of text and you do every other line or every other letter. In this case, I did every other line.
Kabbalistic method?
Yeah, of interweaving.
It's kind of like that William S. Burroughs cut-up stuff, right?
Oh, totally. Yeah. Except in this case, it's not as random because it's every other. It's still very random, but you're taking every other something and you're cross-weaving it. And so I did that with this text, and I'm totally blown away by the way that it came out. Like, it feels like it's a fucking conversation. But it was strange that it came out of such a personal experience and my own extrapolation and something that was so charged with emotion. Like, right. I read this message over and over again, like, as if it were to me. I have no idea who it was to, you know? Yeah, very strange. Very strange.
Well, that temple has those crazy ass energies all over. I used to be afraid to go out there because of the first couple of times it just got so dark and deep out there that I would avoid it. I didn't want to go in the circle. As soon as I'd go inside of the circle, I'd feel the weight on my shoulders. And last year I spent some time out there listening to someone cry, similar to what you're talking about, and sat on the ground and just sat there for a long time taking it. And I don't know. It's not anything to be afraid of. I know that for sure. Can't say I love it.
It's
yeah, it's not necessarily to be afraid of, but to acknowledge the power of it. I mean, I had gone years ago to something that like I can't quite shake. Was I'm not, you know, as far as like a Ouija board goes, it's not taking it so literally as like, oh, this magical instrument or anything like that. But I had this experience where I was at this 3 or 4 day party, and so there was a lot of different substances being ingested throughout the weekend, and there came this point where I was on ecstasy, and someone pulls out this Ouija board, and they're playing with it, and they're like, oh, come play with us, and I was like, I don't know if I'm really feeling that right now, and they're like, oh, just come with us, and like, I touched the board, and just like, tears just pouring out of my face. And I was like, I can't do this. And I get up and I just like, and they're like, what the hell? And I was like, I don't know. Maybe it was like, first I'm trying to like rationalize, like maybe it was like an allergic reaction. Cause like, I mean, like, there's like literally like someone turned a faucet, like just tears and like snot pouring out. Like, you know, like really like emotional, like when you're like just full flushing, like if you've really been sobbing the way you start to like a runny nose and everything. And I was like, literally, I could stop touching it and it would stop. I would touch it and it would turn on. I could stop touching it and it would turn off. Touch it and it would turn on. And it was just this real expression of sadness and sorrow coming through me that was really intense and overwhelming to be a conduit for. And yet, you know, in some way, it felt almost like it needed that, or I needed that, or something. So when you talk about this idea of, you know, connecting to something old, and maybe, you know, it sounds kind of crazy, but like being the vehicle for that expression, it's definitely scary, it's definitely intense, and yet sometimes I feel like these are things that at certain times in our life, not all the time, but certain times in our life, we sort of need to step into and fulfill that role.
It is real. I mean, it's real. We're the ones that are giving it the good and bad label. It just is.
True. Oh, yeah.
It's hard for us to deal with that because we're so used to, we know what we've been taught was bad, and we're trying to avoid that stuff, and we know what we're going for. So it's hard for us to accept that fact, but it really is just the way it is. It's all going to keep happening. There's still going to be blood and death, and there's still going to be the flowers and leaves and stuff.
And we also know like what would be preferable. Like for most people, probably going into the tent and fucking the two naked girls would be a more pleasurable experience than going to the temple and being bombarded by, you know, sadness and these heavy emotions. Yet in the long term, and probably in the short term, it's much more emotionally beneficial, and certainly for your development and your expression, to have that experience than to have an orgy in a tent.
Yeah, my first thought was herpes.
Well, right. So right. Like, that was my thought when you said it. I was like, oh, yeah, I can.
It gets kind of crazy out there in that desert, but it can be a lot of fun as long as you can handle the repercussions.
Yeah.
Are you going to end up with the Valis laser or the Valtrex laser?